Well, good evening, everybody, and welcome to the latest edition of Militia Monday. Today is, what month are we in? We're May. May 21st, and the year is 2010. We're really getting along in this year already. It's gone by pretty quick. Tonight's guest we're going to have on is going to be Gary Hunt. We're going to be discussing part two of the committees, and we're also going to be delving into the question of the validity of the militias as well. And are the militias of today historically accurate and valid? But before we go into that, though, I wanted to make a couple of announcements out there. One of them comes from the Arizona Militia. And I don't know if anybody saw it in the chat room beforehand, and they had sent me a message, but they're starting to put together tactical teams and patrol teams to go out to the southern border of Arizona. They're calling for help. Now, I don't remember if any of you recall the previous during the Waco series that I did with Gary Hunt. But we had talked about the militia going out and helping and how the militia really don't seem to support each other much. Well, this is the time that we can change that. Arizona militia is calling for help. They need help. America knows. Everybody across the country knows they need help. So see what you can do. If you're able to go down there and help, help. If not, find a way to help. Support them financially or do whatever else they can, but get in contact with them. You can find them at www.arizonamilitia.com. They've gotten rave reviews from the Southern Poverty Law Center, in fact. So anybody that the Southern Poverty Law Center does not like, who stands for the Constitution, they're good guys. Fox News also did a point on them. They are the number one militia in Arizona. They're actually trying to get out there and start solving the problems out there, and they're trying to help fix the issues. So do what you can. Support them out. With that being said, I also want to mention the fact that Patriot Resistance is holding a drawing. They're giving away. It's actually a gradual scale giveaway they're doing to help raise donations for their site and some of the programs they're going to start implementing. Some of these programs are really incredible. I'm fully behind them myself. So going into the drawing, they're giving away everything from starting off with an Elk Ridge Bowie knife, which I actually happen to have one of them, and they are incredible knives, up to a full tactical Molly tactical vest with all the bells and whistles attached to it, including a Bowie knife, a compass, and butt pack, and you name it, it's got it on there. So go check out Patriot Resistance. Help them out. See what you can do to help them out. $1, $5, whatever it is. And make sure to enter in for the drawing there as well. So with that being said, Gary, how are you doing?
Just fine. And listening to your introduction and alluding to Waco, I think what you were alluding to was the fact that in Waco, somebody from Indiana called for a militia to go to Texas. And that's not right. That would be an invasion. Arizona, or if Texas militia had asked, or Texas Committee of Safety had asked people to come into their state to assist them, then they're inviting them in. But one state can't dictate what another state does. So in this case, Arizona militia is calling for assistance. There's no reason in the world not to go to Boston to fight the Arizona to fight the British, the Mexicans. Well, you know what I mean.
Mm-hmm.
So
I got a question then. In a situation like this, what do you think the militia should be doing? Do you think they should be going down there and helping out? Do you think other militias should be going down there to help them out?
Well, it's a rather gray area, and there are a couple of ways to look at it. One is historically, from the Magna Carta on, we've always had the right to have a militia. That militia, however, since the Magna Carta, has always been subordinate to a civil authority.
Correct.
So absent a civil authority, it's hard to say that it's much more than a tribe of going to fight a battle. To be a militia properly, it has to subordinate to a civil authority. Now, generally, we accept that the subordination is to the governor of the state. That's the way this country's operated for a long time. In fact, if we want to talk about the federal code that creates the United States militia, there's some serious problems with that. But that's not on the agenda right now. But the subordination to the civil authority is the most important thing. However, the basic right of self-defense exists. Now, as we pointed out in the last program, there was a militia in 1692 in New England that created a committee of safety and then subordinated themselves to that committee of safety to act in the proper capacity, the proper role, by subordinating themselves. And in so doing, then the committee directed them to arrest the appointed Governor Andros and jail him until he was returned to England. So properly, there should be the civil authority. And unfortunately, most of the militias in this country have a good grasp on the concept of militia and the right of self-defense. In fact, a militia is nothing less than the right of self-defense in a collective manner. If you have a right to defend your home, shoot the person that's coming in to harm your family or steal your property, the militia is no different than that. The difference is, when you live in a community, there should be a civil authority that you subordinate to. When you are protecting your own home, you're protecting you are the civil authority. It is your home.
Okay.
And there is no other government that has any right to dictate what you do in your home.
Well, let's start off with this question then. Since we were talking about the civil authority aspect, and we brought in the fact that the militia historically do have to answer to a civil authority, and that's something that you and I have discussed many, many times. In fact, pretty much every show we've had,
yeah,
when we discussed committees, we do mention that fact. That civil authority, whether it be the governor or the committees of safety, but it has to be a civil authority, or otherwise, like you just mentioned, they're just a roving gang then at that point if they don't answer to any civil authority.
Right.
So let's look at the concept of the committees of safety then. If that is a if that is one aspect of the civil authority that the militias have to answer to, who can start a committee of safety, and how do they start a committee of safety?
Well, a committee of safety, now, nobody wrote a rule book on committees of safety. You have to look at history, and so I've concentrated on the history of the United States of America as much as possible to get an idea. And I've seen reference to five people can start a committee, and I've seen reference to three people can start a committee. So there's nothing that dictates anything. John Hancock, on April 12, 1775, put out a call from the Provincial Congress that all communities, plantations, and everything form committees of safety if they have at least five people to sit on that committee. So who can form a committee? Do you have to go to the city council or the county government or the state government to form a committee? No, I find nothing that says that a community can't form a committee. Now, what question is, what's a community? Is it a neighborhood? It could be. Is it a city or the east side of a city or the north side of a city or a town? It could be. If you, in a certain area, have something in common, and that in common is to provide, just say you live in a fairly decent part of the city, but there's a drug problem there and it's not being dealt with. Can the people form a committee there in that region to deal with the problem of drug houses in the community? Yes, they can.
Okay.
Are the police going to frown on it? More than likely. But historically, they have every right. And a good example of what caused in Pennsylvania and in western and northern New York, especially, people to work together to create committees of safety was a threat not unlike the drug threat, but it was Indians. And they formed their committees to set up a structure to defend, to watch for, and defend against Indian attacks. So who can create a committee of safety? Anybody that has something in common that they feel a need for, especially absent the ability of the government to provide that protection. There are no British soldiers stationed out in Lycoming, Pennsylvania, where the Indian raids were going on. And if there were and they weren't defending the people, in either eventuality, the committee or the people have every right to create that that committee of safety for their own purpose. Now, can you create one without a reason? Why not? If it's the right that we have, why not create it and have it structured and in place should the eventuality arise that you need the committee of safety? In the meantime, they can serve a number of purposes, support political campaigns, support issue campaigns, educate each other, a lot of things. If you go to committee.org, you'll see a lot of things listed on what a committee can do outside of defending itself and outside of being the civil authority for the militia. So the Committee of Safety can exist as a collective body of people with something in common brought together for the purpose of effecting outcome of election, potential risk to the community, in anything.
Okay, so basically then, anybody can form a committee of safety for any reason or no reason at all, because it is part of our rights from Magna Carta.
Right. It carries an English heritage, not the Sharia law or anything like that, but an English heritage. It's got 900 years of history.
Okay.
Now,
are there any specifics on how one would start a committee of safety? Is there a set number that has to be, a set number of people that has to be in it? Can one guy start it and say, hey, I'm a committee?
Well,
try and recruit people? How do you go about it?
Historically, in this country, I've found reference to 3 and 5. If you go to committee.org, right on the front page, you'll see a proclamation signed by John Hancock, who was chairman of the committee of the Provincial Committee of Massachusetts, on April 12, 1775, 1 week before Lexington and Concord. And he said 5 people can form a committee. I have found other references where as few as 3 people formed a committee. When we set up the Committee of Safety in Orlando, Florida, or Central Florida Committee of Safety, which is how we styled it because we had 3 counties participating in it, Seminole, Orange, and Osceola County, we had quite a few people come in initially. Now, there was one concern that we have, and if you go to committee.org again, you'll see that we had a little subscription form. Now, people subscribed to the Committee of Safety. They didn't join it. They subscribed to it. Interesting change in terms, but you're not really subordinating it to it. You're subscribing to the fact that we need a committee, and you become a participant in the committee. We excluded law enforcement or ex-law enforcement, bankers, and attorneys, because we recognized the existence of the missing 13th Amendment, the Titles of Nobility Amendment, and that means under that amendment, those people, by attaining the privileges they had from government, had violated that concept, the 13th Amendment, which says that anybody who accepts the title of nobility gives up his citizenship, and so we took that to heart. We allowed people to come in under a false name as long as they admitted it was a false name. And as I pointed out last week, that helped in court in getting an acquittal for one of the members of the Florida Common Law Court, because the IRS undercover agent had sworn that it was his real name, Robert Chapman, when in fact his real name was Robert Quigley. And the jury apparently realized that, well, if he'd lie about his name and lie when he swears to something, then maybe he'll lie while he's swearing in this courtroom. I can only assume that. I didn't talk to the jurors, but it was effective in the defense of Toby Brown.
Okay.
But to form the committee, that's it. You decide whether you recognize the missing 13th Amendment or not, but you set the criteria, you collect the names and addresses and have people subscribe, and there's a form. There's one that addresses the missing 13th and one that does not on the committee.org page. And you can use either one that you choose, but you're looking for that common interest. And I think one of the questions on there, too, do you recognize that there are at least 2 types of citizen in this country, one a United States a citizen, a U.S. citizen, and the other one being a citizen of a state? And those were the qualifiers in Orlando. But once you decide what qualifies somebody to join then or subscribe, then you subscribe, and if you've got 3 or 5 people, then for all intents and purposes, you have created a committee of safety. Where you go from there, there is on the page as well a proposal for a structure that would be a larger number of people. For example, you can have subcommittees, one on education, one on historical research. Any need that arises, you get volunteers, and they form a subcommittee then that discusses and deals with an issue, and if they do have something to bring before the Committee of the Whole, they do, and the Committee of the Whole then votes on it, and nay, and it passes or fails. So they become a quasi-legislative body in that sense. Now, you're obviously not going to enact laws that make it illegal to spit on the sidewalk, but you might agree as the committee to take funds to make flyers to hand out or something like that. So you're functioning, in a sense, like a political action committee in some cases, or you might decide that you wanted to buy lead and powder so that if the Indians did attack, that you would be able to provide the lead and powder necessary to fend off the Indians.
Okay.
So you can form them by getting the people together. Now, we had some 300 people attend the first meeting of the Central Florida Committee of Safety, and of those, I think 86 joined initially. I left Florida.
That's not a bad size to start off with.
Well, Central Florida's got a lot of people there, and we did have the benefit of even a couple of talking. I talked a couple of the television stations into announcing the meeting, and we had flyers all over, and there are a lot of patriot organizations in the Orlando area, and we got the information to all of them, so we had a pretty good turnout. It was rather interesting. Now, this was back in 94, and 93 or 94, and there weren't nearly as many as patriots to pick from back then. You know, the population of the patriot community right now, I would venture, is probably easily 10 times greater than it was back in that time.
I would agree with you. There was none. We were far and few between back in the early days.
Right. It was hard to find. But some cities were very focused. Columbus, Ohio, Las Vegas, Nevada, some of the ones that I'm familiar with, Orlando, Florida. There's others. But there are some communities that were real heavy. The Patriot movement had been very active long before Waco. And back then, a lot of the issues had to do with income tax, driver's license, UCC, and generally it was people by people that had been stepped on by the government at one time or another. My involvement in the Patriot community came when the IRS came and handcuffed my office shut. And when I say that, they took the hood, the oversized doorknob, and lock it with a padlock around your doorknob so you can't get to the keyhole to unlock the door. They padlocked my office over some taxes, and it got me interested. And this is back in the days of there were bulletin boards, and there were 16 KBPS modems. And Richard McDonald in California, probably the premier state citizen, had a bulletin board, and I used to download a lot of information from him. And I'd spend hours on the phone. In fact, in 93, before Waco, or 92, I went out to California and spent 2 weeks with Richard learning from him. But that, you got your information either that way, from bulletin boards, phone conversations, meeting with people, handouts from people, or faxes. And that was our communication back then. It was like the Pony Express. And now it's instantaneous. If you do a flyer, you make a PDF and post it for download, and 10,000 people can have it within seconds of you posting it if they choose to. So things have changed a lot, and we've got a lot more people. Now people are in the community not because the government stepped on them necessarily, but many are in the because they've seen the absence of light at the end of the tunnel in the progression of government, the biggest single issue. And we had a joke back in the 90s, as long as the beer is cold, football's on Sunday night, and the credit card works, nobody's going to really concern themselves with the government. Now, bottom line, if we got serious about it, until there's a severe economic problem in this country, we can't expect people that haven't been stepped on by government to really recognize the problem. But a little over a year ago, early last year, I realized that we have a severe economic problem in this country, and so I kind of came out of semi-retirement in the Patriot community and became very active again, because now we're gathering people that aren't stepped on, but just see that there's a very serious problem with this country, that we've got an insoluble problem in terms of debt. We've got an insoluble problem in the fact that there's more people being fed by the government than feeding the government. And the government continues to spend money like it's going out of style. And they intend to raise taxes again with cap and trade and a number of other ways. So now we've got these millions of people that are potential patriots. Many of them are already. Many, unfortunately, still believe that redemption is going to come from the Republican Party. I think that after November, they might take another step closer to the fence, and eventually they'll climb over the fence and realize that it's going to take some serious work to get our country back, and it probably won't come out of the ballot box. In fact, I just recently wrote an article about the three boxes that's on outpost-of-freedom.com/blog, and then look for, on the top right side, look for the article Three Boxes, and it talks about the ballot box, the jury box, and the ammo box. Now, some people have pointed out I missed the soapbox. I didn't want to write, I didn't want the article to be too long, so I left the soapbox out. But if we have freedom of speech in this country, we're afraid to say things, and that gets into a whole different issue. A lot of it has to do with political correctness. For example, I can't say nigger, so I didn't say it. It doesn't matter if I believe it or not. The fact is that speech has become a crime in this country. I used the term pickaninny in describing Obama when he was a kid the other day on a Patriot list, and I was chastised for it. Maybe it's a derogatory term. I think honky is too, but I don't think they've outlawed honky yet.
Not yet, Kevin. In fact, it's highly promoted on channels like Black Entertainment Television or any other black sitcom.
So when we talk about freedom of speech and think that we have it, we have to realize that really we don't.
Well, this leads me to another question.
Starting to say something that you might have said freely 15 or 20 years ago, and right now you hesitate whether you agree with it or not. If you agree with it, it's because you've been conditioned. If you don't agree with it, you're just afraid of getting arrested.
That's very true. So I got a question for you. We're talking about freedom, and we're talking about constitutionality here. We've just discussed who and how you can start a committee of safety, because as you said, the militia have to submit to a civil authority. Generally speaking, it's a governor, but in absence of that or lack of response from the governor, the committees of safety for their area. So now let's talk about the militia themselves. Historically speaking, how were the militia established? Who established them and how were they set up?
Well, first, let's answer one brief question. Can you be in both the Committee of Safety and the militia? Historically, in my research, the answer is no. There was a guy in Worcester, Massachusetts that was head of, actually, what they had there was called the association. But when he decided to work with the militia, he resigned from the association, which was the equivalent of a committee of safety.
Okay.
If there's a militia now that has offered, written to the governor and said, we're here, you know, if there's a flood or famine, we'll be glad to help you out. And the governor has not said, you can't do that. They're a militia. They have already indicated their subordination to the governor. The militias back then had subordinated their authority in larger matters to the colonial government, the king's governor, but in smaller matters to their own committee of safety.
Okay.
But absent that committee of safety, you're subordinate to the governor. Governor, can you act on your own? No, you can't, because there's no civil authority saying go to Boston to keep the British contained.
But you need to have that civil authority, though.
You have to have that civil authority. So if you've got,
otherwise, we're just kind of like a little warlord out there with his own little group of hitmen or something.
Basically, that's it. Self-serving. And we'll get into rank a little later on, because we've got some serious problem with a general in charge of 23 people. That's just not military.
Okay, I've got one other question for you, though, before we go into that. Okay, and it was because somebody brought something up in the chat room a little bit ago. Now the militia are mentioned in the Constitution. They are constitutionally binding.
Right.
They can't be taken from you.
Right.
Or the ability to join one or create a militia, unless there was an amendment made to the Constitution to get rid of them, and that hasn't happened, so they're legal. Now somebody
guess you're talking about states like the southern states after the Civil War, say Alabama.
Exactly like Alabama. The gentleman was just in the chat room in, at the U of Tredemy site,
okay,
and he mentioned
well,
the fact that in Alabama they're not allowed to have militia. They're not allowed to parade in uniform. They're not allowed to do anything.
So they can't have militia days? Well, let's look at a few things. There's a guy from, I think it was North Carolina, that did a very involved study, a very wonderful one. It's presented on YouTube. It's rather extensive. And I don't have it offhand, but he shows that there were two governments, a second government, an unlawful government created in all of the southern states after the Civil War. I have no doubt of that because of the bayonet was used to get ratification of the 13th and 14th Amendment. A whole different set of rules applied then. So the secondary government that came into place and displaced the original government of the state that was created by the Constitution and the new constitutions the state were forced to create and had to be agreed to by the federal government before they could become a state again, and all the other conditions set upon them did create a second government. That second government agreed, signed an agreement with the federal government not to create militia. But did all the people in Alabama sign that? Or was it just that fake government, actually unlawful government? I think it was the unlawful government that agreed not to establish militia. Could they give your rights away? Can anybody lose those inalienable rights because the government says they've lost them? No, that's
the last time I checked, inalienable meant that it could not be taken from you. You could not be separated from your freedom by anybody, no matter what.
You cannot take these rights away from me. You cannot. You cannot. You cannot. Now, can the state give up its political authority to create a committee of safety? I suppose so. But did that subordinate the people to that government or not? And I would suppose not, because there was nothing constitutionally that denied or took away that right to form militia, that right of self-preservation, self-protection that's indicated in the Second Amendment of the Constitution. So the state can't form it. So you got a problem there. You can't really go to the governor. All I say in Alabama is if you don't have a committee of safety, you cannot have a militia. If you have a committee of safety, you can have a militia.
Okay.
Now, if you want to parade in government-sponsored parades, well, I got kicked out of the Waco press conferences because, as the lady from Waco Police Department said, it's the FBI's press conferences and you're not invited. So if the state or the county or the city who feels subordination to that fake government, the de facto government, you can't participate. They're not inviting you. But if there's if the Chamber of Commerce has a parade and they have no objection to you marching, then it's their parade and you can march. If you have your own parade, you can march. If the Committee of Safety sponsors a parade, you can march. The rules only apply, as was pointed out about Waco, to he who has created the event. So, I mean, militia days were as much a part of the militia as anything else. Can they be denied? They're part of that inherent right. So my answer is, yes, Alabama can create militias. But they should find a civil authority. If their town or the county is willing to acknowledge them, that's fine. They have a civil authority. If not, then they might have to create their own, as happened in New England with Andros.
You know, I think that's a point that we have to remember as a free individual. Our power rests with the civil authority, and the civil authority is we, the people. So if a government will not recognize a civil authority, we do have the right to create our own body for the civil authority.
Right, and you're not asking for their blessings either. You're not going to incorporate, because if you do, you subordinate to that de facto government. And the beauty of the Committee of Safety is, I had a meeting with a police officer in Orlando. He wanted to meet with me, so I had some guys from the committee sit in a booth at Denny's, and then I made sure that we sat so they could hear the conversation and I'd be protected. I wasn't going to get arrested and everything, and talk to this cop. And the story about that is on the committee.org page. But, you know, I explained to him, and I don't know if it was in what I wrote up in the article, that we're not subordinate to the city of Orlando because they've chosen We don't need your recognition to be a committee of safety. This is a collective effort. It's got historical foundation in our country throughout our entire history, and we're exercising that fundamental right to form a committee for our own best interest, to absent the protections provided by the Constitution and by the state, we can protect ourselves. And I explained to him that, you know, it could be for political means. It could keep the militia from picking up their sword, but it's a double-edged sword, too, because it could tell the militia to pick up their sword at the same time. It was a casual meeting. He said, thank you for your time when we were done, and he walked away. Nothing ever came of it. But it was explained to him that the militia, the Committee of Safety has the right to tell the militia to put down the sword or pick up the sword. And that's the bottom line for the protection of the community. Now, let me suggest that there's a lot of Vietnam veterans around, like myself, that are probably too old to go to the field. They might be good in a supervisory or a training capacity, and there's no reason a member of the Committee of Safety can't offer and assist in training the militia. But how effective would they be if you were on a mission to have some 65-year-old guy dragging you down, you know, that you've got to keep him up with you to get out of town, Dodge? So
a pack in a Molly tactical vest loaded down with gear, yeah. They serve better in a different capacity.
They would. And their frame of mind, their understanding of freedom and everything has probably advanced over a lot of the younger people because they've been around for a long time and they've tested the evils of government, and they would make ideal members of the Committee of Safety. So if you've got a militia that's got some old people in it, as much as they'd like to fight, John Hancock wanted to fight, Thomas Jefferson wanted to fight, John Adams wanted to fight, they all wanted to go out and be generals. But they realized that they served the country better by standing and talking and convincing. So a lot of people that are in militia now might want to consider the fact that they're now militia, if you look at it, usually goes to age 45, 15 to 45, 18 to 45, somewhere in that range. And there's a good reason for it, because you become an anchor if the militia has to move fast in a tactical situation and carry along a 65 or 55-year-old person, unless that person's in excellent health. I never saw anything that said you can't be in the militia, only that you are in the militia if you're 18. Florida, for example, was 18 to 45. It doesn't say
after that, I would assume that would be your choice.
What?
After, you know, it was mandatory in the militia between 18 and 45, but after that, or 16 to 45, but after that, I figured it would be your choice. But you're right.
It would be because
what a person with, you know, with the years of experience behind him, not serve better in a different capacity, rather than trying to hump a Molly 3-day tactical pack,
yeah,
you know, and gear and ammo. I think that, you know, I myself am getting up towards the age of 45, and I know that, you know, at 50, I don't want to be humping a pack. I don't think I can. And if I could, I might be a liability.
You're in bad shape, Randy. You know, when I was 45, I could do it.
You know, man, too many years of football and too many years of powerlifting, man. I got two really bad knees.
It doesn't mean that if there's a relatively easy mission they're going on that he couldn't go as an observer and carry a firearm for his own protection. But he's just not a member of the militia.
All right, so that's something to think about then.
I think it is. I've thought about it a lot since I've gotten older. You know, I'm 17 years older than what I was in Waco.
And how have the years been to you?
Well, until 2 years ago when I was still surveying, I was up in Shasta Mountains going up and down 45-degree slopes carrying survey equipment. I was doing pretty good, but in the last 2 years, being semi-retired, thank you, Obama, and Bush, for not having many jobs, I can't find a job. I would rather be at work than sitting here home all the time. But then, you know, God works in strange ways, and since I'm not at work, I'm here at the keyboard writing articles, such as, well, you're aware of the stuff I write.
If anybody hasn't read his stuff yet, I highly encourage you to read him. He's written some incredibly thought-provoking documents, unlike any other government. Divide and conquer. Check out his blog. He's written some incredibly provoking, historically referencing documents.
And especially important one, significant one, is end of the revolution, beginning of independence. It might surprise you what caused Lexington and Concord, but the patriots in western Massachusetts actually forced Gage to do something. He had no choice. He was being chastised by the Crown and the Parliament for not doing anything. They kept pressuring him. He was going to do some things a few times, and he backed away from it. He just could not do anything. And finally, the pressure was there that he had to do something. And everybody was a lot more prepared for it than our history books represent. They'd already had their rifles out. So it's well worth reading.
All right, so I got a question for you. Now, so to recap then. Anybody can join a militia. Anybody can start a militia as long as they have the, as long as they submit to the civil authority, which is we the people.
18, I mean, it's a reasonable age. You don't bring 11-year-olds. During the Revolution, there were people as young as 12 legally going in some states in the militias. And, you know, if your state has a militia law, you need to look at it and see what the minimum age is. And I think since the primary subordination is supposed to be the state that you recognize, that minimum age at least is recognized.
Right, right. Yeah, that's thank you for mentioning that. You know, we shouldn't have to state the obvious, but yeah, you don't want to. 9-year-olds should not be in a militia. They have no business there. I agree with you on that.
No, they could carry a drum or a fife, but put that aside.
Got a firewood, something, but, you know, yeah, I get your point there. So anybody can form a militia. So a militia can be formed anywhere, then, constitutionally. And they haven't changed the Constitution yet, which would require an amendment to it, and that hasn't been done. So it doesn't really matter then what the state says. They can't violate the Constitution and our freedoms.
When we talk about fundamental rights, understand that the Committee of Safety comes under the most fundamental right of all. It's not enumerated in the Constitution. It's not enumerated in the Declaration of Independence. But face it, all rights evolve from one thing, me breathing. Absent me breathing, I have no rights. They all disappear. So the right to protect my life under any circumstances, and we've talked about this, that the Texas law and the John Badell case both enhanced that. That if, in Texas, if people use more force to make an arrest than is necessary, you have every right to defend. John Badell says you have a right to shoot a cop if he's making an unlawful arrest. The right of us to protect ourselves is the most basic and fundamental right at all. Everything evolves from that. Everything evolves from the right for you to protect your own life. Committee of Safety is to protect your own life, to protect your property. So it's
okay.
A fundamental right. We've just got a history that demonstrates how this right is secured in the lower forms, the community form.
Okay, so then let's go into the militia then. More specifically, establishing a militia. What is a legal militia?
Again, we're looking back at American history, at least to the extent that, now I've found some new books. I haven't gone through them yet. I have run across some rather interesting things, but I hate to go to the textbook, but I'm going to go to a book called The First American Revolution by Ray Raphael. It's published in 2006, I think. Let's see, 2002. And I'm going to read some from it so that we get an idea of just how the militia. Now, this is all western Massachusetts. It's not going beyond that, but it'll give you an idea in western Massachusetts how these things work.
Okay.
In Worcester County, the massive mobilization triggered by the powder alarm was followed in shorter order by an even more significant display of force. On Friday and Saturday, September 2nd and 3rd, as they flocked toward Cambridge and Boston, let me interrupt there, that's what was referred to as the powder alarm, Worcester patriots had merely puffed their chests. The following Tuesday, September 6th, they toppled the old regime. No riders were needed this time to announce the momentous event. In taverns and meeting houses, patriots had been readying themselves for a month. militia units had elected new commanders, and they had stepped up the pace of their drills. Militia days, primarily social events for the previous decade, had taken on a new meaning. Musket barrels were cleaned, flintlocks checked, powder and ball rolled into cartridges. All this preparation and the unexpected dress rehearsal provided by the powder alarm would soon be put to use. Now, this is 1774, by the way, before Lexington and Concord. If General Gage kept his word to protect the court, the Patriots of Worcester County faced the strong possibility of a direct military confrontation. The lines were drawn and the stakes were high. Everybody knew the time and place to convene. The 39 militias from Royalston near the New Hampshire border must have departed a day or two in advance in order to reach the shire town of Worcester, 35 miles distant, by Tuesday morning. So too the 51 men from Athol, the 180 from Leicester, 200 from Westboro, and 500 from Sutton, on the other hand, probably rose before dawn and marched into town that same day. We know these numbers from a diary kept by Ebenezer Parkland, a cautious 70-year-old minister from Westboro. Ebenezer's son, Breck, an ardent patriot, attended the event as one of the militiamen and made a special point of chronicling the particulars, which he relayed to his father the following day. In the Parkman diary, preserved at the American Antiquarian Society in Worcester, the roll call of the towns is laid out neatly in three parallel columns. And then they list 37 towns and the number of militia members from those towns. Worcester was the highest with 260. There were a number with 200. The smallest would have been, 38 from Palmer. But there were 4,622 militiamen came to Worcester that day under arms to make sure that the courts did not open, because the courts were ruling in favor of the powerful elite who was foreclosing on property. Oh, well. So the right of militia to force, now that's a little misleading because it said they elected their new officers, and later on we find some conflict with that. But another one, this one is September 6th. Okay, the Patriots of Suffolk County, this is on September 6th, also convened on September 6th, and meeting first in Dedham and then adjourning to Milton on September 9th. With the British Army stationed in Boston, the political hub of the county, Patriots did not control Suffolk to the extent they controlled other counties. They could not forcibly close the courts, but they could and did express their outrage in what would become the only document of the Massachusetts Revolution of 1774 to achieve any significant notice in the annals of history. The Suffolk Resolves, as they came to be called, open with the ostentatious display of rhetoric. Whereas the power, but not the justice, the vengeance, but not the wisdom of Great Britain, which of old persecuted, scourged, and exiled our fugitive parents from their native shores, now pursues us, their guiltless children, with unrelenting severity. And whereas this, then savage and uncultivated desert, was purchased by the toil and treasure, or acquired by the valor and blood of those, our venerable progenitors, who bequeathed us the dear-bought inheritance, who consigned it to our care and protection, the most sacred obligation are upon us to transmit the glorious purchase, unfettered by power and clogged with shackles, to our innocent and beloved offspring. Now, among the resolve were these items. They opposed the Massachusetts Government Act and the Boston Port Bill, stating that, quote, no obedience is due from this province to either or any part of the acts above mentioned, but they should be rejected as the attempts of a wicked administration to enslave America. Although they didn't have the power to close the courts, they recommended that, quote, no regard ought to be paid to them by the people of this county. And then they proposed the officers, the court, and the juries who refused to serve would receive their support. Then they recommended the taxes not paid to the officers, not be paid to the officers of the established government, quote, until the civil government of the province is placed upon a constitutional basis. And that's how they began to fund the revolution before it began. They also demanded resignations from, quote, mandamus counselors. Now, the mandamus counselors were the ones appointed by the king by the under the Boston Government Act that that replaced those that had been elected by the people in the times past, and that they be considered by this county as obstinate and incorrigible enemies to this colony. They opposed the fortification of Boston Neck and appointed a committee to carry their protest to Governor Gage. They objected to the Quebec Act, claiming that the legalization of the Catholic Church in Canada was dangerous to an extreme to the Protestant religion and to the civil liberties of all America. They recommended, quote, to take away all commissions from the officers of the militia, end quote, and that new officers be elected by the people. So they got rid of all the Tory officers by the Suffolk resolves.
Right.
They advocated yet another non-consumption agreement against British merchandise and manufacturers. They endorsed the Provincial Congress. They promised to pay all due respect to the Continental Congress sitting in Philadelphia and submit to their decisions. And finally, as characteristic of all the county conventions, they opposed, quote, all routs, riots, or licentious attacks upon the property of any person whatsoever that they held in a, well, they didn't live by that, though. They burned houses, they tore houses down, tore down fences and things like that. But this, remember, now is 7 months before Lexington and Concord.
Okay.
Now, let's see. Let me find another one here where they talk about the militia and the structure of officers. I thought I had marked the page, and I hope I've marked the page. And apparently I did not mark the page. But what they did is they established for every 20 men a subaltern, the equivalent of a lieutenant, who would be elected by the platoon or the squad and then be commissioned by the Committee of Safety. For every company, they picked a captain who would be elected by the members of the company, or absent a majority or consensus on that, they would be, or with the election, they would either be appointed or confirmed by a commission of the Committee of Safety. The majors then were for the regiments, and so their structure was very military as far as the title of an officer being consistent with the number of men that he held. Now, there were a lot of troops, militia members that would not fight under any officers but their own, and one of the best examples had to do with Ethan Allen and the Green Mountain Boys, who, commissioned by the Continental Convention in Philadelphia, while at the same time Benedict Arnold was commissioned by Connecticut to go to Fort Ticonderoga to seize the arms, Arnold tried to get Ethan Allen to subordinate to Arnold's command. And Ethan Allen's men said, we follow Ethan Allen. If we don't follow Ethan Allen, we go home. That was how sincere their obligation was to Ethan Allen, who had brought them together. And there are many instances of that. So the commissions, in many cases, had to go to the officers that were elected by the people, but there were not, as I said earlier, right at the beginning of the program, there you don't have a general over 23 men or even 300 men. You don't have a general until you have a brigade. And to think otherwise is just ego and flattery.
Okay. So basically, then, commissions and everything would be appointed by the committees. Or would have been appointed by the civil authority, whoever that civil authority was.
Right, because I doubt he, you know, the beauty of having a committee is you go to the governor and say, we want you to commission the officers. And he goes, what do you want me to do? He's not going to commission the officers. So once you have a committee of safety, they can. There's a civil body now that just, since the big government doesn't want to deal with the little shit, the little government can say, okay, we're going to commission the officers. And you write out a commission and issue it to that guy, and as long as he does his job, he holds that commission. Remember, Washington turned in his commission, finally, at the end of the Revolution. All the officers who left the service, that didn't stay on, resigned their commission or returned the document to the government. They returned their commission to the Continental Congress and went home and enjoyed life. So the whole structure in the militia, whether it be by the election of the militia members or not, still needs that legal recognition by the civil authority in commissioning officers who, by that commission, assign their obedience to that committee of safety. And that creates the chain of command that is predicated from the Magna Carta forward.
Okay, so I got a question then for you. As far as today's militia go, when I was talking with, in fact, the first show that we did, our premier show of Militia Monday, we had on a commander from the Indiana Militia Corps, Joshua Goins, and towards the end of the show, we had on Norm Olson. And Norm Olson had brought up a very good point about the identity of the militia, how we lack an identity in that, and that one very vital issue has not been finalized yet. Is it a state militia? Is it individual groups, organized groups? Is it the lone wolf? Is it the cell unit structure? He brought that up. So,
okay, let's address that. A militia, a local militia, subordinates to the Committee of Safety. Again, John Hancock asked all the communities to create committees of safety and then send delegates to the provincial committee of safety. The militias would subordinate the committees of safety. Now, once the committee of safety moved up in hierarchy, let's say three towns in a county have militia, and the county then, they come together with the county committee of safety. Now we've got a county militia that's got the company from this town, a company from that town, and maybe three companies from the other town. So we've started to create a structure, but there has to be the civil element in place.
Okay.
We have a state committee, and now the question arises, how many again? I would say that within a county, if you have three committees, that you can create a county committee. Three small committees, you can create a county committee. This is just a guess. I mean, in Florida, we decided that we were going to have a Central Florida Committee of Safety, which incorporated three counties. Why not? There's no reason not to, because we had a common element. We all chose to put ourselves together in that element.
Okay.
So we would need, say, two or three other committees throughout the state before we could claim the right to have a state committee of safety or the provincial committee that Hancock was a member of.
Okay.
So, As each one structures up, it joins together with those on the next tier upward. And once you have the state committee and you've got three states with state committees, now we've got the beginnings of a national militia. Not a United States militia, though. Don't ever. U.S. Code makes a provision for United States militia, and it has the ages and all that, like most of the states do. Here's the problem with that. Let's suppose the United States, under Obama, calls forth all of the militia members of the United States militia, which,
okay,
I hate to discourage that term because I'm looking at it right now, but anybody who doesn't appear, if there's a national emergency, can be charged with desertion and be executed.
I don't like that.
I don't either.
I don't like that at all.
I don't either. Now, I don't believe that the United States militia in the concept in the federal code is even constitutional.
They never saw, I never saw anything federal militia. I saw state militia. You know, I saw mention of the, you know, the state militia, but I saw no mention of a federal militia.
There is, and I'll tell you what, I'll find it while we're talking, but the concept of union is this. Right now there are 50 members of the union, right?
Right.
If there are 50 members of the union, there are 50 state militias. Can they come together in support of the country? Yes, to the extent that each state wants to participate. But to give the entire control of the militia to the United States government, absent the willing participation by that state, destroys the entire concept of the government fearing the people if they do wrong. The whole idea of the union was that some states might agree and some might disagree. And those that disagree do not have to participate.
Okay, well, I got a question then, because that brings up into actually a subject that Freebird in the chat room was mentioning. Now, he was mentioning the fact that with the structure that you've mentioned so far, you know, each township, each village, whatever it was, would each have their own committee, their own militia that for that area, and those would form a county committee, and then county committees could form together to form the state committee. He was mentioning that would make it extremely difficult to actually get anything done, especially if there was like a, let's say, a state emergency.
It would.
Because you could have, you know, this militia group over here who says, hey, we're not going to worry about your farms over there flooding because we're okay.
Well, that you know, it depends on what the – you can't force the militia from Nebraska to come down and aid the – militia of Arizona.
No. We're talking about within the state. Let's say you have a state with, I don't know, 100 counties.
But again, we're back to invitation until you have a state level. When you have a state level, then that committee of safety can direct all those below it to come. But one can say no if it wants.
Okay, so initially in the beginning stages, it would have to start off as county areas until there was a sufficient number of counties to form a state committee.
Yes, and like I say, it takes, I would say three counties would be a safe number using the example I used. But see, it's not necessarily counties. For example, in Florida, we had Central Florida Committee of Safety, Orange, Osceola, and Seminole counties.
Okay.
Okay, so we had one militia for three counties. Now, if we had three militias, we could, in a sense, justify the state, but, you know, that kind of says, okay, Orlando's going to rule the whole state. So we opted just, you know, the difference between counties there is the color of the street lights or the street signs. They just merged together. So it made more sense to make a Central Florida Committee of Safety.
Okay, so that we could do like a more centralized version, because like Freeman was saying, well, the militia waited for 30 different committees, county committees, to get together to decide on action. The situation's already gotten worse and far beyond intervention at that point. You know, like going back to the thing, like let's say there was a flood in a certain county, and the state militia, you know, the state committee called forth the militia to go forth and help. Then you got 30 county committees who are all gathering together to decide if they're going to go help. And by the time everything is said and done, the disaster has already happened. It's too late. People are dead, dying,
well,
whatever. Property's been destroyed.
You're talking about good deeds, and I'm not sure that the Constitution and our heritage sets up the militia as a good deed organization. It's more than...
Well, let's say it was an attack, then. Let's say it was an invasion from, I don't know, another country. Let's say a border country, like Arizona.
An invasion, if you have a state committee and it mandates that all committees shall go, anybody that refuses, disobeys that order in time of emergency, is subject to execution, isn't he?
Okay. So then, there would be clauses set up in the bylaws then to keep the individual committees as they were even in the past. There were bylaws set up where they had to answer the call to arms. They had to answer.
Well, there weren't bylaws. There was a history. In fact, there was a militia manual, and it's available online, and I downloaded it. It's a PDF. But it's the one that is mentioned quite often that is going to be used as the guideline for the structure of the militia, the training, and everything else. And I don't recall the name of it, but some of those militia people should recognize that there's reference to so-and-so's manual of militia or something like that that was used. But you have to have the tier to have the command. So if I don't have the civil tier, I don't have the militia tier, and everything's voluntary at that level.
Okay.
Once I create the county level, then I've got a tier at the county level. Then the command can be sent because everybody's participating. My committee, your committee, and that committee are all participating in making the decision. Once we go to the state level, again, we've got the collective. We've got delegates from every level of committee at that state level or whatever structure we have, but every county at least, and maybe some cities might be recognized because they don't have a county militia, but they would all be participating in the decision. And then, you know, we're back to that whole concept of the majority says we're going to war, the majority says we're going to war. But as far as helpful actions, I don't think that you can say that a militia from one county has to go to another to help people sandbag the dikes, but I'd like to think that their committee of safety would say that anybody that wants to go there and volunteer their time under the auspices of the militia is more than welcome to go.
Well, that was a bad example. I should have used the Arizona example of what's going on right now, because you've got a huge section of Arizona that's off limits to Americans because it's been overrun and taken over by an invading force.
Quite frankly, you know, I wish they would create committees of safety and legitimize what their actions. My personal feeling is I would take the risk, absent the committee of safety at this time, to protect the borders of this country or this state, Arizona, to invite others down. But is there risk in violating the whole concept of militia and committees of safety? Yes, there is. Is the government going to do anything about it? Randy, you know I'm trying to set up a list. I don't care what happens. Say the president of BP dies of an instant case of lead poisoning in the middle of the night. The first thing I'm going to do the next morning is write an article justifying that he should have gotten that disease in the first place. So if the militia goes down there, if militia from New Mexico goes down there, I'm going to be writing articles in support because the press is going to take the government's view, as they did in Waco, absent another source of information. But what we also found in Waco, given another source, some of them will consider both sides and start weighing the issue. And I think we've got a more receptive press to that, especially with the oil spill right now, than we've had in the last 30 or 40 or 50 years as far as objectivity and reporting. Is it proper? Probably not, absent the committees of safety. Would I defend it? And if I were younger, would I go down there? I used to live in Phoenix or Mesa. I've lived in Aguila, too, out off of 60, past Wickenburg. Would I go down there? If I was down there now, even at my age, I would go down there with them. I would join them as an individual and ask me to give, an intern, not commission, but appointment as a private in their militia. Because if the government fails at doing what it's doing, say protecting us from wild Indians, then we have every right to protect ourselves from wild Indians, whether they be Mexican or Iroquois.
Okay.
I don't see that you can argue against our ability to do that. And if an emergency arises, do we have to take the time to put the structure in place? No, there's an emergency. There's people invading this country right now. The government is not fulfilling its obligation under the Constitution and the laws of the United States. Do we have a right to protect our property? Yes, the collective right to protect the borders of Arizona definitely exists. So there's an argument that under the exigency, the lack of time to create the committees and structure everything properly, that we're responding as necessary, but I would hope that they would back themselves up from a legal standpoint should the government ever try and make issue with that of having some people back home wherever they came from working desperately to get a committee of safety together so that the proper historical structure exists.
So then right now, for instance, let's take the Arizona militia. Apparently they're the number one militia in Arizona. They have members throughout Arizona, so technically then they could form their county committees and their state committee tomorrow.
So what you're trying to tell me is they don't have a committee of safety in place, but the Indians are doing war dances.
Yeah, let's assume that they do not have a committee of safety in place in Arizona.
Well, they don't, and the Indians are doing war dances, right?
They're war dances.
Should we say that they have the right to defend themselves because they haven't gone through the proper structure? No, we shouldn't. They have every right to defend themselves against those attacking Indians. But they should also consider that they need to move towards getting it in the proper historical perspective by pursuing having some people back home, pursuing creating the committees of safety so that there is a civil authority that recognizes and directs them to this. And it might come 6 months, it might come a year later. But as long as they're in the motions, the intent is there to create the committees of safety, however long it takes. If the effort's going on, I think it would be hard to argue the contrary. I can't believe that Jan Brewer is going to direct the militia down there. So they've got to create their own committee and go arrest Andros or protect themselves from the Indians.
Okay. So basically then, well, let me ask you this question then. Well, like you just mentioned then, and Freeburg was just mentioning it then. He said, in fact, here, I'll mention what he said. If it comes down to it and shit hits the fan, then the whole debate about committee of safety approving an action is a moot point anyways, because this current administration is not going to acknowledge any constitutional committee of safety in the first place.
Well, there's no such thing as a constitutional committee of safety to begin with. It's an inherent right. It has existed in our heritage for 800 years.
Okay. So it really doesn't matter if they accept it, if they acknowledge it anyways. The point is that we get to form it, and then we can battle it out with them later if need be. But in the meantime, we need to take our own personal responsibility for our own safety, and we have
right
to do this.
Let's say what we give the press absent a committee of safety. Oh, we've got a bunch of thugs or warlords down there at the border shooting Mexicans.
Correct.
Now, if there's a committee of safety and there's a civil direction, people sitting around a desk say we need to send people down there to protect our borders, that makes it a lot harder for the press and gives the patriot press that want to, what I refer to as McVeigh syndrome, we want to take away the stigma before it's attached, will argue that there's a civil body behind them. It directs them to go down there and protect our interests. And now the press can't really call them warlords. They might, you know, there's a lot of idiots in the press, but it gives other members of the press, the ones that do think and do want to be objective and present both sides, a position to present something on our side. There's politics. It's not winning the hearts and minds of people, but politics is a necessity. Let's look at Obama playing golf or the guy going yachting.
It's all about public relations.
They weren't going to be down there mopping up oil anyway, and there was probably nothing they could do in that 3 or 4 or 8 or 10 or 12 hour period of time, but it looks bad.
Right.
And that's just a warm fuzzy. That's an emotional reaction. But there are emotional reactions, and they affect a lot. And once the story gets a foundation and goes out, for example, flame-throwing tanks in Waco, it's hard to get the truth out. So if we can get a truth out, or at least a consideration of a truth out, in the early stages, we've increased our emotional and political influence in the final decision of the people that are going to be reading the news. And that's important. It happened in there was a lot of, the Declaration of Independence was nothing less than a propaganda sheet to get the sympathy of the world behind the effort of the rebellious colonists in the British colonies of North America. It was a propaganda sheet. It was written to the world.
It was pure PR. It was just pure PR.
It was good PR, and so is the effort of putting together a committee of safety. Because you're saying we're not warlords, but there's an emergency. And as soon as that civil body is in place, we will subordinate to them. But until then, we've still got to protect our lives and our property.
Okay. So now just to clarify then, let's say we're talking about Arizona militia today, the border incident that's going on, the fact that there is a gigantic area of Arizona that is now off limits to Americans because it's been invaded by drug dealers and cartels, and the government's doing nothing. So, absent the federal government doing anything, the state government doing anything.
What kind of land is that you're talking about?
I forget, man, but it's a huge area of land coming up into the U.S., coming up into Arizona.
Let me make it clear that's public land. Public. P-U-B-L-I-C.
Okay.
Now, does public mean government or people?
It means people.
That's right. It belongs collectively to the people of this country. The only role the government has in it is to maintain it for the people.
Correct.
So it is your land that is being invaded. That belongs to you. If there's 20 million people in Arizona, each of you owns 1/20th of every grain of sand out there. 1/20,000,000th of every grain of sand out there. It
yep.
does not belong to the government, and don't mistake that. It does not belong to the government. It belongs to the people. It's called public land. It has been from the inception of this great country.
Okay, so now in all the research that you've done, let's take Arizona Militia. Absent any civil authority right now that they have, I don't know if the governor has recognized them, but let's assume that he hasn't, and he hasn't commissioned their officers. Let's assume that they don't have a committee of safety who has commissioned their officers. What can they do?
Under the emergency condition that exists currently, I think that they have every right to operate, as many militias did back on April 19th. They gathered from all around. I mean, people just grabbed their rifle. They might not have been a member of a militia. They grabbed their rifle and went and did what had to be done. A number of them stayed over through the entire siege of Boston.
Okay.
And they just found an officer and said, can I join your group? There are a lot of people that did that. People would walk up and say, I'm not with anybody. Can I be with you guys? Or he'd look for a friend of his and say, can I join you guys? A lot of that happened. And you're doing the same thing. Under the emergency, you got to do what you got to do. But I think it's imperative that people consider and start taking the steps to establish that authority. Now, if the, I hate to say working from the top down, but if it's necessary and you've got members of that militia from three different counties, assume that you have the authority, and, hey, I'll back you up in writing. I'll find some way to defend what you're doing, but assume that you have the authority then to create a committee of safety, an Arizona committee of safety.
Okay. So they can start working with it, and because they have numbers, they have the people in the different counties as well. I mean, they're statewide.
Right. So we'll...
It's very easy for them to create the state committee
and back them up
with their civil authority then at that point.
Right. They've got the civil authority, and then they can assist the counties in getting their act together. And it's going to be a lot easier to get one body together statewide and then start working on the lower bodies. The intent's there, the subordination to civil is there, and you've created and you're exerting the effort to structure it properly. But under the circumstances, we haven't had the opportunity until we realized the government has just abandoned their responsibility, and now we've got to act, and we're structuring the committees of safety, the civil authority that we will subordinate to, absent Jan Brewer coming in and taking responsibility. If Jan Brewer comes in and says, I'll take responsibility, I disband the militia, then we give it completely to the Committee of Safety, just like they took it away from those that denied the British Constitution to the people in Massachusetts. But the structure is there. And the reason we had a smooth transition of government during and after the Revolution is there was never absent a government in the colonies during the entire course of the Revolution. In Russia, in France, and all these other countries that lived the revolutions, there's been an absence of government. There's been power blocks, I forgot what they call them, the ones in France. You know, you get a group of people, and after a while, they were lopping each other's heads off.
And the Huguenots in them?
Structure. What?
Was that the Huguenots in them?
No, I don't think it was the Huguenots. It was the ones that were running around Paris with the funny Liberty caps on and lopping off everybody's heads.
I can't remember the name of the group. The Huguenots were the ones that were persecuted.
They were persecuted. But the ones that were running the revolution, they had no government. It was just a mess. It was the epitome of democracy. whoever could get the most votes at any one time would say, take off his head, he's my competition. And they would. So some of the people that started the revolution had their heads cut off by the same people that followed them just months earlier. But we had a smooth transition of government without a hitch. There were some hitches, the Articles of Confederation, the Constitution, but they were just minor bumps in the road. They weren't even a pothole as far as affecting a smooth transition of civil authority from one to the other. And I don't know of any other case in the history of man that I've ever run across that had such a smooth transition of power as a result of a rebellion or revolution.
No, there was always overthrow. There was always fighting afterwards. There was always murder and massacres.
Right, and he who was the most powerful generally came out on top unless he was assassinated. And then the second most powerful guy became the most powerful guy until he got assassinated. And that's the way, unless they protect themselves sufficiently like in Russia, but that's the way revolutions run, with the single exception, the great experiment that was conducted and is still going on here. And the rights that we had coming into this still belong to us. Now, if you read John Locke and the Declaration of Independence, you understand the purpose of government. And when a long train of abuses demonstrates that government is no longer conducting its function properly, it is our right, it is our duty to replace that government more conducive to the purpose of government. And that all came from John Locke's Second Treatise of Government. I think it's chapter 19. I mean, that's
great
all
book.
In Locke's work.
Great book. John Locke is one of my favorite philosophers of all time.
Hard to read, though, sometimes.
He is, but you know what? Deal with it. Learn to read him. He's a must. I truly believe that he is a must read for anybody.
Oh, there's no doubt about it. I mean, he laid the foundation for the first part of the Declaration of Independence.
Yep, if it wasn't for Locke, you know, a lot of these ideas that we have today would not exist if it was not for Locke.
Right. The whole concept of self-government as we see it would not have existed without John Locke's Second Treatise of Government.
Well, listen, I got a question.
I can't say it wouldn't have, but we do know that it came from that, and even the founders acknowledged that Locke was the primary source of the concept of the relationship of people to the government and the right to overthrow a government that abandons its responsibility, as they are in the southern border of Arizona.
Okay, so now I've got a question for you then, because we went over this now, but I want to reiterate it. So according to you, because I've heard a lot of people argue about against this point, you know, the cell unit structure of the militia versus a single state entity. So now basically what you were saying is that through historical documentation, technically all the militia were cell units. They were the group for that area in which
they
were.
They weren't cell units. They were, depending on, I read you the numbers, 38 in one case and 260 in another. So
right.
A big town has got a bigger unit. You can call it a cell, but I wouldn't call it a cell in the concept of, say, Louis Beam's leaderless resistance by a long shot. It's just like a state. Some states are smaller than others. Some are bigger. So the National Guard is effectively smaller or larger. Some towns, some counties are smaller, some are larger, so their units are going to be smaller or larger. Presumably, each one can muster a company, but if not, then they can work with some other towns to get the company and then build up the regiment and all that. But they exist until they're assigned to the next higher level. They exist totally subordinate to the Committee of Safety that they fall within the realm of.
Okay. So then, the word cell, I hate that word, but it's being tossed around so much in the Patriot community anymore, the cell structure. I don't like it, especially when you see a lot of people that are using it. They sit there and they look like gang members or Taliban. I mean, that's just the reality.
You know, John Rowland, J-O-N, John Rowland, Constitution.org, he and I disagree on some things on the Constitution, but for the most part, I think we're pretty much in agreement in a lot of what the intent is. And one that we talked about is I wrote an article, and it's on my blog. It's called Our Security Team. And we had a security team in Florida back in 92 and 93 that had no intention of subordinating to civil authority. And initially I was thinking, you know, this is really illegal. unlawful. But John pointed out that it's not, because we have a right to protect ourselves. So as long as I create that security team for the protection of the members of the team, then it's legal. It's just like you hiring a bodyguard, or Nancy Pelosi hiring a bunch of armed bodyguards and saying nobody else can have a gun. It's a right of self-preservation as long as what they do is totally within the law.
Okay.
So to create a security team, and if you read the structure of that, we had anticipated perhaps unlawful activities, supply runs, things like that, whatever was necessary. But John straightened me out on it. Yes, we have every right to do that collectively. Now, can I say borrow your bodyguards because I feel a threat over here? And that's, again, why I say that if you're going to call them militias, you have every right to defend your borders in Arizona now and call people from other states to defend your border. But I would suggest that you start the process of legitimizing the structure. But yes, you have every right. That's fundamental. It's just like the security team, as long as your purpose is lawful. Now, if somebody charges you with an unlawful act, that's where you get run into a bit of a problem. Now, if you're a militia properly constructed and you've followed the instruction of the civil authority, have you committed an unlawful act, unless it's blatant, like lining people up and executing them?
Right.
Without trial. No, it's not. If you're defending yourself, if you're setting up an ambush to take out armed people that pose a direct threat, but if you take unarmed people and line them up and shoot them, that's a crime. And even the civil authority should take action against you in that case. But if you're setting up an ambush to take away the threat of armed people and you kill them all and some of them are unarmed, the old saying, kill them all and let God sort them out, comes into play when a lot of them are armed. You have no choice.
Guilty by association?
The best thing you can do is create that civil authority. Now, this goes back, 93 is when I began studying committees of safety, and I realized something. You know, when I went to Vietnam, before I went to Vietnam, I was in Germany, I was in the United States in the Army, and the idea of killing somebody never crossed my mind, except in basic training or in the context of battle in the military. But when I went to Vietnam, I faced a reality. There's going to be people here trying to kill me, and I'm going to kill them. Okay, I got two. I got the legal ramifications of killing another person and the moral ramifications of killing another person. Well, I could look, what I realized in 93 is when I went to Vietnam, I could look over my shoulder back at that flag flying over my country and say, they sent me here to do this. So they have taken responsibility, absent abuse on my part, for both the legal and the moral responsibility that come with taking the life of another human being. So when you have a civil authority and it says you shall go to Arizona and assist those people down there in securing the southern border, the moral responsibility is taken by the Committee of Safety. The legal responsibility is taken by the Committee of Safety, and in both cases, absent abuse of that force that you're going to wield. And the whole concept of subordination to civil authority has to do with that. Your warlord's out murdering people, or your militia acting in a capacity to protect your property. But again, due to the emergency, can the militia act absent the civil authority? Yes. But should they pursue creating that civil authority so that the moral and legal responsibility falls on the committee instead of on the militia? Definitely. I mean, I can't stress that enough, that you have my support 100% if you even talk to people about starting a committee of safety and they're contemplating having their first meeting. But absent that, you're warlords.
Okay. Well, this is good to know, because, you know, I know right now that there's, like I mentioned earlier, the Arizona militia has put a call out. They contacted me and, you know, asked me if I would assist in that and put the call out. They're asking for help. They really are.
I understand, and I would encourage people to go, but I would encourage them to understand what we've just discussed. Now, quickly before the program's over, I want to read 10 U.S.
Let me check. I think we're down to the last 5 minutes or so. What do you know? The last 5 minutes.
10 U.S. Code Section 311, Militia Composition and Classes. A, the militia of the United States consists of all able-bodied males at least 17 years of age and, except as provided in Section 313 of Title 32, under 45 years of age, who are or who have made a declaration of intention to become a citizen of the United States, and of female citizens of the United States who are members of the National Guard. Then the classes of militia. B, the classes of militia are, 1, the organized militia, which consists of the National Guard and the naval militia, and 2, the unorganized militia, which consists of the members of the militia who are not members of the National Guard or the naval militia. That is U.S. code. That's the one that scares the shit out of me, because anybody between 17 and 45 that doesn't muster when they're called can be charged with desertion and executed if Obama declares a national emergency. That is not right for the United States, the federal government, to have that authority. And I think this came into being in the early part of the 20th century, 1910, somewhere around there, 1908. But what it did is it subordinated everybody between those ages, every male between those ages, to the federal government, and took them away from their state militia. Now, the whole concept of union, again, is each state is the one that has the militia. It's the member of the union that has the authority to participate or not, depending when the president calls. So,
one last question for you, because this will probably take us toward the end of the show. It comes from Ironside in the chat room. And he asks, Gary, what role should the militia conduct in cases like the G20 meetings, when the NWO police force uses anarchists to do property damage? Then it gave the fully armed police the excuse to smash up and arrest peaceful protesters. What should have been done? What should have been done there last September?
What should be done if people don't like the Committee of Safety meeting? Do they have a right to disrupt a meeting? I would say the militia has no role at all in that.
No, they're saying when
it's
the
hard call, but. I think individually everybody has a right to defend himself in that position, but I think the militia has no proper role because that's a private meeting.
Okay. So what about, though, when the police are actually starting to abuse people? Like, let's take the battle in Seattle.
Go to my blog and read Popping Cops.
What's that?
Go to my blog and read the article Popping Cops.
Popping Cops? Okay.
Popping Cops.
All right. So Ironside, there's your answer from Gary there.
There is no authority for the militia to get involved in a private dispute, which is what that is. Now, the police in this country constitute a standing army in violation of the Constitution if you look at history. There was no such thing as police forces. The sheriff was the sheriff that would deputize people as he needed to do what he had to do. The idea of a police department or a sheriff's department that's got hundreds or thousands of guys, armed guys on the streets, is an absolute violation of the subordination of military authority to civil authority. They have guns, they use them, they don't get permission. They've been given blanket permission, and if they kill you, they get time off with pay. That's paid vacation without coming off your paid vacation time. So they, Popping Cops was written with that in mind.
Okay. All right, so any last closing? We're down to our last 90 seconds. Any last closing thoughts here or anything? Hello, Gary? I think I lost Gary.
What?
You there, Gary?
Yeah.
Okay, we're down to our last probably about 75 seconds or so. Any closing thoughts?
I applaud the people in Arizona, and I applaud anybody that goes to assist them, and I encourage you to heed what we've discussed tonight. My purpose, if something happens, if shit hits the fan in any way, shape, or form, in fact, when the Hutterite militia got involved, I wrote an article called Thought Crimes. Now, the Hutterite militia was the first militia I've ever seen infiltrated, coming up with alleged illegal activities that was allowed out on bail. West Virginia militia never had that opportunity. The Viper Militia in Phoenix never had that opportunity. We are prepared to defend your actions with words and make sure the press understands there are two sides to every story. So please follow that advice. Start creating that civil authority so that you have somebody to subordinate to, and you will find 110% support from Randy and myself and anybody that writes on behalf of the Patriot community.
One final question, and this is going to go into the archives. This won't be broadcast, so you'll have to download it to get the answer to this. But Ironsides wanted a little bit of clarification on that. He says, Gary, I'm talking about the Ron Paul protesters who were there doing their constitutional duty to fix Washington and were then abused and beat the hell out of by the police there.
If we now, the government has used the police to effect political discourse. But the militia is above the police in their respect for the Constitution. Am I right? The police do not respect the Constitution. The militia wish to respect the Constitution. That being the case, there is no way in hell the militia can get involved in political activities. Otherwise, we're ruling by force.
Okay, so it doesn't matter then what the cause is. It's a political activity, so therefore, like protests and things like that, the militia cannot be called out to...
But every man has a right to defend his life. And if a cop has a gun, is he going to use it? You're going to wait until he uses it to find out? That's
popping cops. And go back to that blog where you talked about popping cops.
Right. Or the one in self-defense, which talks about John Bedell. That you don't know. If the cop pulls his gun, is he going to use it or not? And are you going to wait to find out?
Well, that seems like a fair answer then. All right, well, I think we're beyond the time now. We're in the archives now, actually, so we're not even broadcasting anymore. So we're pretty much done, unless you want to close out anything. Why don't you toss your website out there, your two websites out there, so people can find you and get in touch with you as well.
Okay, the Outpost of Freedom is outpost-of-freedom.com. All the articles we've talked about, I think, can be found on /blog after outpost-of-freedom.com. If you want to learn anything about the committees of safety, there's quite a bit of information available at committee.org. That's committee.org. And I want to thank you all for listening again.
All right, everybody. Well, thanks so much for tuning in. That was Gary Hunt from Outpost of Freedom and from committee.org. Incredible writer. If you haven't read any of his works, I highly recommend that you read his works. Some of the best I've written, or some of the best I've read in a long time.
Yeah,
he also has
prepared
the "You Have Tread on Me" document that you'll find on the front page of a link to on the homepage of a website. Gary played a major hand. In fact, he wrote most of that. I had very little to do with it. I mainly did some of the business stuff, the economic things like that. But Gary played the major role in that one. It's an incredible document. I've got nothing but rave reviews about it. So check out his works. Great mind, and I think that we're all lucky to have somebody like that who's actually speaking out in favor of the Patriots, the militia, and the committees. Next Sunday, we're going to be doing our Survival Sunday show on shelter. This will be the fourth episode in it, and the Militia Monday, not sure what we're doing there yet. I will get that one squared away for you, and I'll let you know then. It'll be up on the website. You can always find out what the upcoming shows are going to be by going to the radio link on the U of Treasury website. Also, again, just remember, Patriot Resistance is having a drawing. Go there, enter, help them out if you can. And that's about it. Get involved. Think for yourself. Be free. Be independent. Your life is yours to defend. It's yours to keep. Nobody has the right to take it from you. Remember this. Nobody has a lawful right to infringe upon your right to life. The second you give it up, you've lost everything. Your freedom is yours to keep only if you're willing to keep it. Nobody can take it from you. It's just freely given up. With that being said, everybody have a wonderful night. You take care, and we'll see you again this coming Sunday. Bye-bye.